We all know the Jaws scale, and it works just fine for most movies. Jaws for an excellent film. Jaws 2 for an above-average film. Jaws 3 for an okay film. And Jaws 4 for a bad movie. But Alfred Hitchcock's body of work has demanded that we create new classifications, the Psycho Scale. As Hitchcock's best-known film, which just happens to have several sequels, Psycho sets the pace. The Psycho Scale has the same ranges as the Jaws Scale. But we wouldn't want the master of suspense to feel like he's being disrespected.
This is the scene of the crime. A crime of passion, filmed in a way you have never seen before. And as no one else would dare attempt, but the screen's master of suspense, the producer-director who shocked the world with Psycho. This is the apartment of a man named Jeffries, a news photographer whose beat used to be the world. Right now, his world has shrunk down to the size of this window. He's been watching the people across the way. Nobody seems to pull their blinds during a hot spell like this. He knows a lot about them by now. Too much, perhaps. For instance, down there on the second floor, the woman pacing about. He calls her Miss Lonely Hearts. So lonely that even death seems like a friend. These are the newlyweds on a honeymoon no one will ever forget. He calls her Miss Hearing Aid, an artist of a very odd and strange art. The songwriter who plays the same melody over and over again. A genius or insane? This is the traveling salesman and his invalid wife. Out of their arguments and nagging comes a weird kind of love. Miss Torso, the body beautiful. That is, viewed from a safe distance.
Those are just a few of my neighbors. First I watched them just to kill time, but then I couldn't take my eyes off them, just as you won't be able to.
And you won't be able to take your eyes off the glowing beauty of Grace Kelly, who shares the heart and curiosity of James Stewart in this story of a romance shadowed by the terror of a horrifying secret.
Everybody, and welcome to Is It Psycho? And once again, as we are doing Is It Psycho, we have our usual panel of Alfred Hitchcockian fans. We have Mr. Sean Whalen.
It's a pleasure to be here.
Always the case, my friend. Mr. Blaine Dowler and Mr. Trey Hooks.
Hello,
How
everyone.
How are you all doing?
Hello.
So today we are here to take a look at what is commonly considered one of Hitchcock's best. I think when people make their list of his top films, the order might be different, but I think this is one that's almost universally in, say, everybody's top five for Hitchcock. This is one that I saw, as we've talked about with some other movies, this was one that had been held back and then was released in the 1980s. And I saw this in the movie theater when it was re-released before they actually came out with the VHS copy of it. And then I had a VHS copy of it. And then I had a DVD copy of it. And now I have a digital copy of it. You might use that as a little bit of a judgment on what my ultimate rating is going to be on this. But I liked this from day one, and what I would say just as a brief mini thumbnail review is that this movie paved the way for a lot of movies, and I think you need to look at this one, and you wouldn't get the full pleasure of it if you're not watching closely, because there's a lot of things going on that are visual and a lot of things that are in the dialogue. And I think it's a, you know, it's not one, it's not an action heavy movie, but there's a lot going on, and there is the master of suspense doing his thing there. So how about you, boys?
I saw this for the first time in a film class, and fell in love with the movie. It was part of we'd done a couple of Hitchcock films, and saw this one, and I've seen it twice in the theater since. There were opportunities through Cleveland Cinematheque and things like that to see it on the big screen, which is really just a great way to see this one. But that's been my experience with it. It was a film class, wrote a paper on it, and just. It's been kind of my history with it, and the film's been around with me ever since.
I think I first saw it with the re-release that you mentioned, Paul. My dad was a film buff and was really into Hitchcock, and when all of those came out on video, I clearly remember watching Vertigo, North by Northwest, this, and Dial In for Murder with them. And this is the one that I've probably seen the most. This is probably like my fifth or sixth viewing.
Okay. And in my case, the film class was the second viewing. I took two film classes in my degrees because that was not my major at all. You're only allowed to take those two if you were not a film studies major. We saw Psycho in the first one, and that got me kind of hooked on Hitchcock. And I was trying to collect his library, so I saw this on DVD before my second film studies class, where it showed up in class. And I have seen it multiple times. My wife was raised in Vietnam. They didn't have a local movie theater. The closest they had, after their city got electricity when she was in high school and she no longer had to study by candlelight, one of the neighbors got a really big TV, and that was the theater. They would literally charge admission to watch stuff in their living room. She hadn't seen any Hitchcock, so I introduced her to Hitchcock with this when it showed in the local theater. And now she's gone through a lot of his library with me. This is a good one, to the point that if I was the host of the podcast, anyone who rated it Psycho 4 would never be invited back for anything.
you guys are always invited, even if you come up with something like that I can't imagine is going to happen. So we'll see when we get to the end. So I find this one interesting because, you know, I think people look at this at a superficial level sometimes, and they say, well, the Jimmy Stewart character must have been gay because he wasn't going after Grace Kelly enough. And it's like, I don't think that's what the message they were trying to send there was. And I think that, you know, there is a story arc for his character, and there's a story arc for her character, where they live in two different worlds, or they were raised in two different worlds, and she's more willing to shift to his world because of how much he cares, whereas he's not really willing to give up the life he's led. And ultimately, you know, spoilers, ultimately she does move into his world at the end, and you think, okay, these two kids are going to make it. So I didn't really see that subtext that people talk about there. And, I think to me, that's just the, get that point out of the way quickly, because I see it mentioned too many times, frankly.
Yeah, no, I would say, he's an adrenaline junkie and he's physically attracted to her, but he ultimately finds her boring. And as she gets more caught up in it and becomes just as much of an adrenaline, you know, rides that same adrenaline high, he becomes more and more attracted to her.
See, I don't even think he finds her boring. I just think he's not willing to give up the excitement that he has for her. Mm-hmm. He's willing to have her there, but he's not willing to settle down, so to speak, and stop living that life. Mm-hmm. But I agree with you. I think then, you know, as she starts getting a taste of it, she starts getting into that same world.
Yeah, I would agree that I don't think he finds her boring. I think his vision of married life is boring. Mm-hmm. And it's marriage to anyone he's saying no to, not just marriage to her. All right, because, I mean, well, on the one hand, I do understand why some people would say, you know, if Grace Kelly's throwing herself at you and you refuse to catch, how can you not be gay? But yeah, he's at the point where if he wants someone, it's going to be a woman. He's just not sure if he wants someone in that way at this point.
And yeah, I mean, he's clearly catching. He just doesn't want to marry.
Yeah.
There's also in the film the arc of him with this voyeurism obsession. He gets into watching what's going on outside of him because we get very focused on the murder, which is, you know, the main crux of the film. But it isn't just the murder. And I think that's really one of the keys of the film is that there's so much stuff. Like, he gets involved in everybody else's story. And that becomes an obsession of his to the point where I don't know that it's even so dismissive of her. We all have our flaws and things like that. Actually, one of the things I find interesting about his character is the humanity of it. I mean, that he's got an obsession. Voyeurism is going to be a thing. It may be a thing for that character for his whole life. I don't know that he'll be able to let that go. Although one could argue with where the film goes for him, maybe that will break him out of it. I don't know. But that piece was a whole other layer on everything that I think everyone was saying here is very true about his interactions with her. But he had that on top of it. And I do think part of the attraction comes when she kind of gets drawn into his obsession as well, which I thought was intriguing. Her character having an arc, I think, is really critical to appreciating that relationship's journey throughout the film. If she was just this one-dimensional character, I don't think I would feel the relationship the way that I do by the end of the film. Her character is also extremely well developed throughout, which was something that really worked very well for me.
I could even argue that this is Hitchcock's best developed female character, even compared to movies where the female characters are the lead.
I don't necessarily disagree with that. I think you have a good point there. And I think, you know, realistically, I think her character has a story arc. His doesn't really. His character is a kind of a point of view character because we're kind of seeing everything through his eyes as this goes on. But he doesn't really change at all. He doesn't, you know, there's no point where you feel like his character grew or did anything. He just solves this, you know, mystery and, you know, or with the help of his friends. And, you know, I don't think his character actually goes through any sort of arc, whereas she does. She becomes an adventurer, so to speak, by the end of it. And yeah, and as I've,
I would
as,
say her
as we
arc
said
is
when we
much more pronounced when, than his.
I'm sorry, what's that?
I would say his or her arc is much more pronounced than his, but he did start to at points he was regretting the voyeurism. Don't know if that stuck or not, but he did definitely open up to the marriage, which was his major obstacle at that point. So his, you know, his arc might have been 15 degrees where hers was more like 90, but they both had arcs.
Well, and this could be reading way more into it, but it's Hitchcock, so maybe not. In the final scene, his wheelchair is purposefully turned away from the window instead of facing the window.
Mm-hmm. And considering Hitchcock considered dialogue should just be sound and everything should be told with visuals, you should be able to understand any film on mute. Which we'll probably get to when we talk about his Juno and the Paycock, but I think it works. And one of the reasons I think this works so well, like as Sean said, you see he's involved with all the apartments. This movie wouldn't work if every apartment didn't have its own story going on. People with no names, like they're talking Miss Torso and Miss Lonely Hearts. He doesn't even know their names. They're just nicknames. But every single one of those apartment windows is telling a story.
And I think that's a good point to move into, because I think as the story develops, that is something that, to me, it's one of not only one of the things that we're seeing in the movie, but it's also one of the themes of the movie, is that I think there is a theme of community there and showing how they all live their independent lives and that there's some interaction, but some of these people are living 30 feet from each other and they still don't know each other at all. And I think that's an interesting comment on the whole community. I thought it was fascinating the way they show each thing. And this is one of the things I was talking about when we first started discussing it, that you have to watch this closely, because in order for this movie to have the rich feel that it should, you need to kind of have that voyeurism with Jimmy Stewart's, what's his character, Jeff? You need to have you need to follow with him and kind of learn who these people are and kind of have a feel for each of them. And then you see what's going on and, you know, you question whether or not his conclusions are accurate or not. Although, you know, in a movie like this, I think they had to be. But there's the whole, you know, the whole progression there that you pick up. And if you allow that just to kind of sweep you along without being part of it yourself, then I think you lose a little something.
And I think a big part of driving that question, is he right or is he wrong? It's not just his detective friend saying, well, we found these personal reasonable explanations for everything. It's how he and Grace Kelly's character look at the dancer, Miss Torso, with her male guests and interpret those scenes in a completely different way. Where Jeff is saying, oh yeah, she's got her pick of the litter. And Grace Kelly's character is there going, no, she's juggling wolves. You don't understand the balancing act she's doing. Right. If anything, she's got them there in numbers for her safety. She doesn't explicitly say that because it's 1954, but in 2024, I think there would be that comment, no, there's safety in numbers. They're inviting four suitors at once who are not necessarily going to gang up. It's a form of protection.
Yeah, that's an interesting
I read some interesting facts about the Miss Torso character, that she wasn't actually a dancer, but Hitchcock let her do her own choreography. And she liked the apartment so much from this expensive set that was created that she actually was living in the apartment as much as she could in reality. Like, they, as much as they would let her be on set, she was actually basically living there for most of the shoot.
Well, you mentioned the influence of this in the opening, Paul, and I don't want to take us too far afield. When you think of shows like Seinfeld and Friends, where where everyone's referred to as a description, right, versus actually knowing people by names, I think there's a direct through line from Rear Window to that. In terms of Miss Lonely Hearts, Miss Torso, etc.
Yeah, and the common elements in that is we're talking about characters who are separated from society, and they, especially Seinfeld, one of the defining attributes of that they brought to bear as the series finale is their lack of compassion and empathy for their fellow man. Right. That was a key element, and that's part of knowing them by personas and not their actual names, not taking that extra time.
But I think that's also, maybe, you know, if we're going to talk about one of Jeff's story arc things, is as this whole thing develops with Raymond Burr's character, he seems to develop a little bit more empathy and he seems to care a little bit more, as opposed to just being, you know, nosy or you know, getting a vicarious thrill out of people. He starts becoming willing to risk things in order to, solve this. So I do think there's a development maybe of some empathy.
I did like when the dog passed and the woman was chastising the entire apartment building for a lack of empathy, you know, like we all lived together and, you know, this dog just loved people and how could you kill this dog? And she was chastising the entire apartment building for the fact that nobody seemed to care about any, you know, we all live together here, but nobody seems to care about anybody. So it's interesting. That theme was definitely something that was part of the script intentionally. She kind of broadcasts it when that whole sequence happened. But I thought that scene was really appropriate considering everything we were watching And while these characters all seem to have these little arcs, they did seem, for most of the film, they seemed very disconnected. We did see some interactions between people as the film continued, especially Miss Lonely Hearts and the composer. They have their own little arc that's going on. But there is a lot of disconnect between the different apartments in the building as it was going through, which is interesting. And so it's as Jimmy starts connecting with the world more, I think the apartment in and of itself seems to be evolving a bit too.
There, I did see some criticism of this one. Again, I didn't buy into it, but they were criticizing the age difference between Jimmy Stewart and Grace Kelly. I think they said he was 48 when they made this, or 46, somewhere around there. And she's in her 20s. And they made a big deal about that. And I can understand where that age difference might be disconcerting to some people, especially back in the 1950s. But it didn't seem to really have anything to do with the narrative in the movie. It was really just the casting. And it didn't jump out at me all that much. And if you don't tell me what their ages are, if you don't say he's in his 40s, she's in her 20s, it didn't really seem to be an issue to me. But I did see criticism on that. I was wondering if any of you had any thoughts about it.
I don't think it was any more pronounced than other Hollywood films of the era. They will take a popular male and a gorgeous female and put them together, and that's your couple. And the popular males have often been acting in their adulthood for a couple of decades. And the women, it seems like if you're around 30, no more than 35, you can be the female lead, and then you don't get a job until you're past 55, and then you're the grandparents. So when you have a 40-something male, they're just not willing to cast an age-contemporary woman. In a lot of cases, sometimes there's exceptions. I remember when we looked at Jimmy Stewart and Doris Day in The Man Who Knew Too Much, It looked like a much bigger age gap than it actually was when we checked their birth dates, just because Doris Day had aged so much better than Jimmy Stewart had. So, yeah, I think it's an issue, but it's not an issue specific to this film as it is so much Hollywood in this era.
Yeah, and you know what? I'll just say, to some extent, Hollywood to date, there's still a little bit of that goes on, that somehow, it's on film, men age more gracefully than women. And I'm not saying that as a fact. I'm saying I think that's a perception. You see some of these women when they get into their 40s and 50s, there's just not the juicy roles for them that there were. Whereas, men seem to continue until they decide to retire.
I think it may have stood out more if you had a less capable actor as the female lead. I mean, Grace Kelly was beautiful, and she was one of the best actresses of her generation. People would talk about her more if she hadn't have become royalty and retired when she did.
Yeah, I would grant that. And you're right that there are women who build careers on being gorgeous who are not good at the acting part of the job. And Grace Kelly is not one of those.
There's also a reality of this one that she was quoted as telling a magazine that she thought that Stewart was one of the most attractive men she ever met. So, I mean, the chemistry between the two, as far as the actual interest was there, there was something that was there. I mean, Stewart's wife, I was reading an article about this, that Stewart's wife, Gloria, insisted being on the set every because of that particular factor. So, I mean, as far as, is this crazy? Is it ridiculous? Not really. there was something there.
Whereas most of us, if we were, contemporary to that and acting with Grace Kelly, our wives would probably say, yeah, she's going to fool around with you. and just kind of laugh it off. But I could see where
there's concern that the feeling is mutual, then they're stepping in.
I could see where there would be, you know, just a perception of her being just one of the most attractive women in film at the time, certainly, and probably historically as well.
Well, yeah, I mean, honestly, I mean, the criticism, it's like, oh, well, he had to be gay if he's not jumping on board as soon as she offers herself. She's one of those women where, you know, if someone who looked like that expressed this much interest in me, I'd be like, okay, what's the scam? What's your play? Because
yeah, I think I would probably feel a similar way. Of course, you know, all of us feel our wives are that beautiful. So nobody, you know, we all got that scam. Let's put that on the record.
Yes.
I think one of the things that's impressive about this film is there's a lot of diegetic sound, but by and large, you could almost view everything that plays out in the apartments that Jeff and Lisa don't directly interact with as exercises in mind. What goes on in the songwriter's apartment, what's going on with Miss Lonely Hearts. We hear background sound, but unless they're directly interacting with Jeff or Lisa, there's not a whole lot of dialogue in the film.
Yeah, even the musical score is largely created by the songwriter. He's playing that piece of music that evolves. Hitchcock wasn't super happy with how little evolution he hears in it. He wanted a little more in the development of the popular tune. But yeah, that's definitely built in. It's one of his more visual movies. This is one of the ones where he presented himself with a major technical challenge. Aside from the death of the dog and the climax. So you take those two out in this 111-minute movie, you've probably got about 105 minutes where the camera is in Jeff's apartment, pointed one way or the other. He was trying to tell the whole story from that one restricted point of view.
Now, just by way of dialogue, if you put on the closed captioning, you do get some of the dialogue in the various apartments that they're looking in that's kind of muffled, and you might get it, you might not, but if you have the closed captioning on, you get the words. So that's kind of, it was kind of a cool aspect of it, because when I kind of felt I did not need to rewatch this movie to talk to you guys today, but I did anyway, just because it's Rear Window and I wanted to watch it. And this time on, it's the first time I ever watched it with the closed captioning on. So, you know, there's not a lot of insight that's given to you, because as you kind of mentioned, Hitchcock presents things in a way where you don't necessarily need the dialogue in them. You know, you could see by the actions what's going on, but it's still kind of cool to add that little level to things.
Yeah, I just want to throw out there, the reason there wasn't that much progression playing was because the composer was kind of holding on to Witch Doctor for himself, because the person who played the songwriter was Ross Bagdasarian, who would go on to create Alvin and the Chipmunks.
Yes, from Rear Window to Alvin and the Chipmunks. Yeah, I from what I saw, there was really very, very little in the way of score, except at the opening and closing portions of the movie, and the rest was all the diegetic sound that you mentioned. And they were able to get away with that by working in the songwriter and, you know, the music he'd be playing, or the dancer and the music she'd be playing. And this way you'd have some music going on while this was all happening, which I thought was a pretty cool way to do things. But it does eliminate some of our ability to critique the score. What did you think of Raymond Burr in the movie? Because I thought he presented as fairly menacing when the time came. And you know, a guy, you know, just looking from across the yard, a guy you wouldn't want to mess with, just from what you saw. So I thought he was well cast. And then the interesting part is that he was supposed to be, what was it, David Selznick, that Hitchcock was parodying.
Well, I felt like he read more Jackie Gleason in the beginning. I mean, he was large, but the way he was henpecked and sweating all the time, you could see why someone would doubt Jeff. But from the moment the dog dies and everyone else comes out and you just see the glow of his cigar in the dark apartment, he is super sinister from that moment on.
Mm. Yeah, he nailed that balance between, you know, when we're only seeing him when he doesn't think he's being watched and it's only Jeff looking at him or Jeff's friends, right? Then you know, yes, this man is capable of murder. You totally believe it. But when there's others there, you don't. Which, yeah, as you said, it's a critical element for the plausibility of the story. It's a tough line to walk. I mean, honestly, my only criticism of Lars Thorwald has nothing to do with Raymond Burr, and it's whoever decided his hair needed to be white. Because
I think that's purely for the parody element of it.
Yeah.
But I didn't think it looked unreal. I only think it looked unreal if you knew who Raymond Burr was, and you could kind of say, no, he didn't have white hair back then. But otherwise, if you didn't know his character at all, I thought it came off okay.
Well, then they should have dyed his eyebrows, too.
All right. I'll accept that. As seems to be the case often with her, I think an unsung MVP was Thelma Ritter. I loved her character in this movie. I just thought she was fun. She was like the common sense person often, but she also got totally into it when the time came. The only thing about it is I don't know how many home care workers are who are that involved in their patients' lives. That might be stretching reality just slightly, but there's probably some out there that are like that.
Well, and she played important story points above and beyond just kind of being a sounding board and an instigator. She's the one who sees the warning signs with Miss Lonely Heart. I know what those red pills are. I know what she's about to do.
Yeah, she gave us some ability to move the plot along and also to give us some exposition. But just the same, like mm-hmm. I said, she was just fun to me, just her attitude and her presentation. So I got a kick out of her in this movie.
Yeah, she could find that line where she's presenting that she doesn't care and throwing out some great barbs and beautiful comments, that, you know, little digs. But, you know, deep down she does care. I would not be at all surprised if Rhea Perlman studied this performance to play Carla on Cheers. That's what Carla, the first season Carla wasn't the Carla that we became, but starting about three quarters of the way through the first season, through the other 10 seasons of Cheers, it's the, you know, Carla's a very Stella-like character, if Stella was horny.
and extremely fertile. I guess the only other, I'm sorry, were you going to say something, Sean?
Stella's interactions with Lisa, I think, were pretty key, too. When you have that whole sequence where they're going over to the other side and actually interacting with the garden, when Lisa's getting ready to climb the fire escape to actually go into the apartment, those two going over together, there was something about that worked, and you needed Stella at that point to be invested. Like, she was intrigued by all this too. She was drawn in because she was a skeptic early on too, just kind of like everybody was. Mm-hmm. But I liked that in her arc, we got to see her get to the point that both Lisa and Jeff were at. And that was something that was, it was a fun little journey with her. She was a great character with that. I actually enjoyed seeing the two of them, and it actually made sense to me that the two of them would team up and go over together, kind of the buddy system, the way that it worked out. It just seemed like something that it generated more excitement, whereas I think Lisa going over there alone would have made no sense to me at all. But them going over together kind of added to the whole I guess, reality of how you would be interacting with something like that, where there's danger there, but there was also excitement because, hey, I'm not going over alone. There's going to be somebody there with me. We can kind of do this. It just made sense in a very interesting way.
It also left Jeff alone for that sequence, which was vital to keep him isolated. If Stella had stayed behind, the movie could have fallen apart in that point. We wouldn't get our conclusion the same way we got it. But like you said, it felt natural. So if we can accept that Thelma is one of the home care providers that gets that involved, as we said, you know, some are not. I suspect some of those that are not are doing it more as a defense mechanism if they tend to have the patients that are unlikely to survive whatever they're caring for. If we're talking about someone with broken legs, they're probably going to pull through, so she doesn't necessarily need that same level of armor if this is the kind of patient she's been taking on. Right? Or at least in this case, maybe she's more able to get engaged with Jeff's life because he is the safe one. He's not going to, you know, keel over and die tomorrow because of this injury that she's helping him with.
Yeah, I think there's an element of some home care providers genuinely care about their patients and get emotionally involved. Some keep keep everything at arm's length. And then there's others that just, you know, for them it's a job and that's it, and they don't really think of it one way or the other. But I do think the latter two are more common because, you know, first of all, it requires a level of empathy to get involved in the people's lives. And second of all, if you are an emotional person and you get involved in their life and something happens to them, that's a problem. Or even if nothing happens to them, but then you're dealing with somebody with broken legs and the legs heal and now, he was part of your life and now he's not. So I can understand where, for the most part, home healthcare workers do not get involved in their patients' lives.
I was going to say, I like how Hitchcock stayed focused in this film. We get enough about Thornwald and his crime to become invested the way Jeff becomes invested, but this isn't really about his crime. We never find out why he killed his wife specifically, who was the woman who helped fake being Mrs. Thornwald. None of that is expanded on because it doesn't matter. But directors today would feel the need to tack another 15 minutes on the movie to fill in those pieces. But you don't need them here.
It actually made it more realistic. Mm-hmm. Because there are things like, why would Jeff know those things? I mean, I actually really liked the choice because you're right. I think today they would have done that. And I think it's a mistake. I actually really like the fact that this felt different because the pieces that we don't know, you're right, they don't matter, but yet they added this element of reality that they're in Jeff's position, he wouldn't know those things at that time. Why would he?
Yeah, I agree with that. And also it would eliminate the whole question of, is he right? Did this, you know, unless you do it as kind of a something at the end to say, oh, and this is what happened. Oh, we picked up his accomplice or whatever, you know, but it's unnecessary.
Right.
So
I did like the feeling that, like, I was looking through the window with Jeff. I think that's something that this film captures really well. And if you start to become invested in the film, you know, whether you agree with Jeff's voyeurism or not, that's not the point. The point is, when you're sitting there as a viewer at that time, you are seeing things in real time with Jeff. And we have the lens into that world that's Jeff's lens that none of the other characters really have, because we're there when he's alone doing this, which is something that I thought was just really well captured in this.
Absolutely. The film opens what? With the shade raising, and ultimately the end of the film is the shade lowering.
Yeah, I think, you know, it is, I mentioned, you know, he's our point of view character, no question. And I think it's critical that you kind of ride along with him. And I do think the other characters tend to put enough shade or doubt on his conclusions that you start saying to yourself, well, is he right? Isn't he right? You know, you kind of ride along with it, mm-hmm. and you're making your own decisions. And again, I think because it's a movie and for it to be, well, there was nothing that went on, I think that would be kind of an empty ending to it. So, you know, if it just turned out he was wrong and the wife comes back at the end, I don't think that would have worked. So that's the only reason I kind of felt, well, he's got to be right. But otherwise, you know, I think there was enough, they came up with enough plausible deniability for you to wonder.
Well, the wife could have been at Bible camp learning to be more judgmental.
That is
for those who are listening who don't get that reference, that's the Simpsons spoof of Rear Window when they thought Ned Flanders killed his wife, but he hadn't.
There was I was going to mention also that there was an episode of The Flintstones, which was actually my first exposure into this story, called Alfred Brickrock Presents, and they had a neighbor who was a you know, a parody of Alfred Hitchcock, and Barney and Fred thought that he killed his wife. And at the end, it turns out he did. But he gets away with it in the episode. And I always found that extremely amusing. Mm-hmm. As a kid, I liked it just because I thought it was funny. But then as I got older, when I saw this and saw the parody aspect of it, I really enjoyed that. So what are the themes, if any, did you guys see in this that came out of it?
I don't know. The only sort of prevailing thing that ties every window together is love is hard. Right? So mm-hmm. many of these, like the newlyweds, you can see like the man seems to be feeling henpecked already. Every time he goes for a cigarette break, he gets called back into the apartment. There's the entirety of his Lonely Hearts. Although she does seem to be on a better path with the songwriter at the end, right? Where those two come together. You know, Miss Torso's boyfriend returns towards the end. She's happy. She's made her choice. But every single one of these stories seems to be driven by romance on one level or another.
I get a kick out of when Miss Torso's boyfriend comes back. He's this, you know, what would appear to be, you know, a little wimpy guy, which is not what you're picturing her with. And she's, you know, obviously mm-hmm. thrilled that he's back, and he's worried if there's enough food. I found that to be an amusing little thing that they put into it. So, I guess, you know, we should just talk a little bit about the direction in itself. And how difficult I think it would be to continue with this story and make it where you can kind of accept or understand the lives of these people and still have it be interesting to want you to do more, to cause you as the viewer of the movie to want to be a voyeur, which is, you know, Jeff's role in this movie, for you to want to join him and think and not think, well, he's creepy that he's doing this. No, you're watching it and you're right along with him, or at least I think so. You start being curious. Well, what's this? What's going to happen with these people? What's going to happen with these people? And I thought they did a good job of making these people interesting enough. The people who sleep out on the fire escape, the dancer, the songwriter, the mm-hmm. lonely girl, the people with the dog. Although I would be terrified to lower my dog on a little rope down from whatever the third floor down to the courtyard. I think that's crazy, but, you know, whatever. But I thought that really mm-hmm. was the challenge for Hitchcock, and I think he rose to the level beautifully, to be honest.
Yeah, I would agree that that's a huge part of it, and so much of it is visual. Because these apartments, like Trey already said, it's an exercise in mind. You're not intended to hear the dialogue, although, as Paul said, some of it showed up enough on the soundtracks that the closed captioning kicks in. But it was not the goal, right? The plot does not depend on you hearing the dialogue in these apartments. And so much of it is visual, even before that, just like setting up why Jeff is in the cast. They start the movie with just a slow pan, and you see the car crash with the loose tire that took him out. And it's right there. It's on the wall. And you don't need a word of dialogue to understand, oh, that's where the leg got broken. And it tells you right there he's a photographer. It builds the whole thing right off the bat. This is, you know, a staple of Hitchcock, is telling the stories in a purely visual format. He's lamented a few times the fact that movies got sound at all. He liked it as a purely visual medium back in the silent era. And yet he's one of the few directors that stayed successful after the transition. A lot of people who were successful in the silent era could not transition. Writers, directors, and performers. He pulled it off. So at no point do you feel like the sound is an intrusion. It's all natural because he gave us the whole thing from Jeff's perspective. We are mostly limited to that apartment, keeping most of the musical score diegetic because it's the songwriter making it, right? Otherwise, keeping a lot of the score out. It's just a master class in how to compose shots and put it together.
And he does it physically. And what I mean by that is there are no what we would consider close-ups or extreme close-ups of anything that happens in the apartment. He physically maintains the distance with the shot from Jeff's window to their window.
Yeah. I mean, this part of the budget in this, it was a $1 million budget. One of the most expensive parts was building the courtyard, because Hitchcock couldn't stand actually filming on location or outdoors because he could not control the weather and he likes to control everything. So yeah, a lot of this movie was filmed with the camera in Jeff's apartment specifically to make sure, oh yeah, we want to make sure that people think it's from Jeff's perspective. Let's put the camera where Jeff could be and film it that way.
The heat wave, right? Not only does it add to the tension because everybody is sweaty, there is a logical reason for everyone to have their windows open.
Mm. Yeah, good point. Yeah, I think it was critical that they did not do any zoom-ins on the people. It was always from his perspective. Even when Lisa and Stella went over there, it was still from his perspective. You never got a close-up of what was going on. And I think that was critical because that was the whole point of this movie.
You know, really, only the zoom-ins were when Jeff did the zoom-in.
Yeah, with the
again
with
maintaining.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I really liked that the set. It's the acting talent that was a part of all this was just top notch. But I really liked that the set was something I wanted to walk around in. Like, I got why the character who played Miss Torso wanted to be there so much in reality, because of the fact that it was such a dynamic set. Their use of lighting and making it seem like it was a very real outdoor environment, I thought was very effective, because I just thought it was just a very, very cool place. That had different nooks and crannies, and you know, this idea when people were approaching his apartment, you know, this idea of the multiple floors and using hallways to hide and narrowly miss being seen and stuff like that added to suspense. You know, there's points in time where Lisa's in real danger, and I just loved the use of different angles and hall. You actually felt like you were navigating through this place, and I think that's very, very hard to do, and that was very effective.
And when Lisa's there and he's confronting her, I think that was the most suspenseful point in the movie. That was the point where you felt the stakes were real, and what's going to happen here, you know, that's and you felt Jeff's helplessness. That he wants to help her, he's calling 911, he's doing, you know, whatever he can to get her the help she needs. Mm-hmm. But is it going to come in time, and what's going to happen? What's this guy going to do? Because we already have come to the conclusion that he's a killer. So, you know, where is this going to go? And I thought that was just really, really well done. And keeping that distance from it, not being able to zoom in to get everything that's going on, to interfere with what's going on. That's the frustration and that's the suspense, and that's where, you know, Hitchcock always stands out.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, even to the point where she was showing that she got the wedding ring, it's on her finger and she's pointing at it behind her back, and Thorwald sees it, and we know now Thorwald knows where to find this man. Right? He's had the phone calls, but he doesn't know who's doing it. He doesn't know why. And then in that moment, we're saying, oh, yes, Lisa got it. Oh, but Thorwald knows she got it, and he knows who she's communicating that with. Now mm-hmm. Jeff is in personal mortal danger because he had some level of insulation until that moment. I thought with a movie like this that I've seen so many times, I'd be able to multitask. So I had it on the just my workstation. I've got the computer that my chair is pointed straight at where I do work, and then I have a TV just off to the left for multitasking and watching some things. That I didn't get a lot done when this was on because it's just one of those things that sucks you in. So they're going, why is my neck sore? Right, because I've been looking to the left instead of straight ahead for about half an hour now. Right, okay. Go back and, oh, whatever it sucked me in, I was halfway through a word in that email reply.
The one thing...
kind of felt... it's riveting right to the end.
The one thing that... I don't know. It just... I remember the first time I saw it, I thought the same thing I thought when I saw it yesterday, or the day before, whenever it was that I rewatched it. But it's like, why is Raymond Burr so stupid that he doesn't close his eyes when he sees what Jeff is doing? You know, that was the one thing. Like, if the first time he did it, you know, I totally get it. But the second, third, and fourth time, you think, well, you know, you should figure out what he's doing here and be able to, you know, to navigate that, whatever, 10 feet that's separating you from him. So that was probably the only thing that stood out to me as an issue.
I think the one spot where the effects at the time let the film down, because I think realistically it would have a... I understand it would have a compounding effect. Like after the first one, just barely as it started to clear, everything would blur again with the second, and then things would stay blurry after the third and fourth because of like the repeated flashes, but I don't think they could convey that, so you have the sense of just the same thing happening over and over, a flare out, he clears his eyes. So I think that was more of whether he closed his eyes or not, realistically, he would have been blinded after the second flashbulb, but they just couldn't really convey that.
And he's also moving through a completely unfamiliar apartment in the dark. So, you know, he doesn't know if he's about to, like, walk into a coffee table or anything like that as well.
I guess.
I think Paul froze up.
I can hear you guys. Can you hear me?
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah, I guess that's the case.
Your image hasn't moved in a good 5 minutes, but...
Okay. Well, hopefully everything's recorded, okay? Because I heard everything you guys said. But I guess that's a fair explanation for it, but it was the one area that I didn't feel it was totally conveyed as well as it could have been, put it that way. And it wasn't a critical problem, but it was just something that stood out to me a little bit.
No, I get what you're saying, Paul. I mean, with what we see, Thornwald basically does, there's like a 5 minute scene that's on repeat, essentially. Thornwald steps, Jeff does the flash, Thornwald adjusts his glasses, wipes his eyes. You're not wrong. I'm just trying to know.
Yeah, and the one thing about that scene that I do like is that at that point, Jeff's only weapon is his camera. You know, he's got nothing else to defend himself with. Mm-hmm. So I did think that that was an effective thematic part as far as that goes.
I did like how Jeff, in that sequence, when the two of them are like almost struggling, you know, and Jeff winds up going out the window, I liked the pacing of that. I liked that it wasn't just this like fluid movement. It was an actual battle. Like, to, you know, Jeff was struggling to hold on and not wind up going out the window and all those people. It was like a multi-step process. It just felt more like a real struggle between the two of them, where sometimes in film it's almost too fluid. This felt very, it was dirty, you know, I mean, how it was handled, which I think was something that was a really good choice. Because to me, it added more of a realistic sense of danger to what was going on with Jeff. Then sometimes when they do it, you know, if Thorwald seemed real competent at, like, he throws people out the window all the time, I think there might have been something that was less realistic to me. I really enjoyed the choice there. It's just something that I think a film sometimes loses that. And I felt that felt very natural.
Yeah, it's one of the rare cases where the two people fighting who have no fighting training actually fight like they have no fighting training.
Which, yes, that is refreshing in its own way. Yeah. It was great.
And it also does show a little bit of Thorwald's state of mind and how stressed he is. Could be back to why he didn't close his eyes. He's not thinking rationally because he's still pushing Jeff out the window after Jeff has been calling for help and the whole courtyard are watching. So there's no way he's going to be able to get away with whatever happens to Jeff, even if he can get away with killing his wife. If Jeff died on that fall, they'd be going, okay, you killed this guy. Now, why did you did it? And dig in, and they got his wife. Yeah.
I think he's given up on getting away with this now, and he's just getting his revenge. I think he's, you know, he's in a state of absolute just, you know, lunacy in its own way. I don't see him thinking rationally in any respect at that point. But,
yeah, because there's...
Go ahead.
There's at least two people at this point that he has to deal with. And one of them he can't get to. So I think you're right, Paul. He knows he's cooked either way.
Yeah.
Well, and Jeff reveals that he's cooked. I mean, you know, in the sense that when... one of Jeff's mistakes was when he walked into the apartment and he's asking about the ring... Jeff's basically telling him, there's no way for me to get this back to you. Because he's in there, like, trying to negotiate with Jeff. Mm-hmm. And Jeff's posturing really at a time where he's got to be very careful. Because I thought this was honest and true, too. Jeff's not going to be any expert in how to negotiate with somebody who's coming over there as a murderer and doing those pieces. This guy walks through the door, and he's basically trying to say, okay, what do we get? You know, what do you want from me? What are you really after here? And Jeff reveals very early on that, like, there's no negotiating here. They got the ring.
Well, maybe if Jeff had been a little bit more cognizant of what was going on, he would have tried to just bluff him for a little while until help could get there. But I don't think, you know, it's spur of the moment. Like, he doesn't have time to think this out rationally either.
Yeah, and his whole profession is to watch things from the outside and not be involved, right? He's the photographer.
Mm-hmm.
Right. He's not used to having an impact on events. He's just used to documenting them and going for the shot. So it was a mistake, but it is a mistake that is 100% in character to make.
Well, and he's not thinking about himself in the moment, right? There's a respite. And what does he do in the respite? He gets a hold of Doyle and says, he gets Thelma to go run with the bell and tries to get a hold of Doyle to get Lisa out. Not Doyle, run over here. I'm going to be in trouble in a few minutes.
Yeah. Yeah, very true. Though, you know, one of the other shortcomings, as far as I'm concerned, is that was one of the most unrealistic falls out of a window that I've seen, I guess, since Vertigo. It's, you know, the special effects of the time didn't really allow for, you know, for that to look. Although, you know what, it took a long, long time for them to improve upon that, because Hans Gruber falling out the window in Die Hard looked very similar to that. So, you know, 30 years later, they hadn't really improved on that particular special effect.
Yeah, so most of his fall actually looked realistic because they got a giant cushion and actually had someone jump off the Fox Tower. So the exterior shot is an actual stunt person who just jumped, and they had enough cushioning to be okay. But that's a day for a diehard, our comment for a diehard podcast.
Yeah, I was going to say Alan Rickman just had the benefit of training that Jimmy Stewart didn't. It's different acting styles.
So, I guess
The one thing I liked about Jimmy Stewart's fall was I liked that there was some attempt to break his fall, to catch him, which sometimes is sometimes those clean falls, it's like, how's this person even still alive? In his case, you get at least at the end why, he wound up with another broken leg versus something far more severe because of the fact that at least a portion of that fall was broken by people down below.
Yeah, and the also, I think one of the things that impacted their ability to make it look realistic and in a negative way, I guess, was they had to show that the fall wasn't 30 stories, because you said, otherwise it would be unbelievable. So they had a very short distance to show that fall over, which I think, when you're showing it from the window looking down, you have to basically blue screen it or green screen it or whatever color screen they had. And, you can only do so much with that.
Yeah, I think maybe the only thing they could have done is had Thorold push him a little farther the first time when he's sort of hanging on the sill. So then he's definitely falling feet first. And you've got – Jimmy Stewart is not a short man. So you've got the rest of his height covering part of the next story. Give people time to get under him to catch him. But as Sean pointed out, the fact that they are trying to catch him and break that fall really helps accept that, he's got at least one – additional leg break afterwards. Who knows, maybe the leg in a cast gets broken more or again, but yes, it's all the damages in the legs after landing feet first, and they prevented concussions or whatnot.
So unless you guys have something else on this, I think we can come over to our ratings, which I think I know already.
You know what we should, before we move on, we're on Is It Psycho. Hitchcock's cameo in this is around the 26-minute mark. He is working on a clock in the songwriter's apartment.
Yes, and I thought this one was extremely easy to spot because of the nature of the movie and the way this was all being presented. You're kind of watching closely to each apartment, and when they got to that one, it's like, oh yeah, there's Alfred Hitchcock. Only I thought it was
If your eyes are on the screen and you know what Hitch looks like, you see it.
Yeah, it's as simple as that, honestly. I'm going to say on this one, I have zero doubt. This should have been certainly it should have either been a best picture or a contender for best picture, as we were discussing before we started to record. There's no question. It wasn't even nominated, which I don't understand. But I think historically, time has been very, very generous to this movie because the movie earned it. And I think people look at this, like I said, I mentioned this to one of my friends the other day, and he said, oh, that's my favorite Hitchcock movie. And I think that's not an uncommon view. I wouldn't put it as my number one, but it's no question in my top five, not even close. So I just think it's a great movie. I think it paved the way for a lot of things that we saw later. I think if you look, there's certain movies where they show a voyeuristic point of view, and how they developed a plot from that, and I think this one paved that way. It's a psycho. It's no question about it. It's not even debatable.
Sometimes with suspense movies, when you know where it's going to go, you know the ending, it loses something. This is a film that is infinitely rewatchable. I find myself keying in on different things when I end up rewatching it. I enjoy hanging out in this world, which is really interesting. It's funny with just, the whole premise of everything. This is definitely Psycho for me. I mean, I have trouble placing some of my favorite Hitchcock films as far as where does this fall. this one's very fresh for me because I've just rewatched it. But if it's not my favorite Hitchcock film, it's certainly up there high on the ranking. I would say, right, if you're asking me right now, I would say, oh yeah, it's my favorite one right now. There's a couple I have to rewatch in order to really place that. But this certainly falls in that category. This is a great movie.
Yeah, it's. I think you would be hard pressed to find someone where this wasn't probably in their top four Hitchcock films. I'm not prepared to say this of all of Hitchcock's films, but out of the ones we've covered so far, I think this has the best cast working at the top of their game together. It's Psycho.
And for me also, Psycho, this is my favorite Hitchcock. And considering Hitchcock made at least 5, if not 10 films that are at that Psycho level, saying it's the best of those is something. I mean, I do not understand. When Trey and I did our 99 Years 100 films on the Waterfront, I remember us saying, why was Rear Window not in the nomination pool? Right. I think Trey was leaning to On the Waterfront, or at least hard to make that call. I would say On the Waterfront is great, but Rear Window's better. I mean, Hitchcock was nominated for Best Director, didn't win. Grace Kelly won in that year for The Country Girl. Edith Head, costume designer, she won in that year. But again, for another film, specifically Sabrina. And yeah, as much as she did with Grace Kelly, you know, costuming Audrey Hepburn. Yeah. Like she took that home too. This is the year though when costume design in black and white and color were two different categories. I don't understand why Rear Window wasn't in the costume design category for Edith Head. When you look at, you know, Grace Kelly's outfits as the model, and there's like a plot point where she doesn't wear the same thing twice. Like, I mean, Hitchcock wasn't happy with the score. I didn't have issues with it, but this is one where nobody involved did the job poorly. Mm-hmm. And there's a lot of why wasn't it nominated in this category questions for me. Like this should have done so much better at every award show. I am just baffled.
Yeah, I can't disagree with any of that. Clearly we're all recommending, if you have not seen Rear Window, see it. And I don't think, even with the spoilers in this episode, I don't think we've spoiled any aspect of watching, of the viewing pleasure of this movie, because as we've all mentioned, we've seen it multiple times and we continue to enjoy it and see more, and everything about it is just top notch. But what are we doing next time? Because I think we're going to go off of the beaten path a little bit, aren't we?
Yes. So the next time we're together as a group, we are launching our next director focus, looking at Stanley Kubrick. So Kubrick ended up directing 13 features and 3 short films. And we are kicking off that coverage with those short films. So we are looking at The Flying Padre, The Day of the Fight, and The Seafarers. I think all three of them together are about a 1-hour running time. Flying Padre and Day of the Fight are both available on YouTube. They have fallen into the public domain. I think, Paul, you said you found The Seafarers on Amazon Prime in the U.S. markets. I have it on the Blu-ray. It's a bonus feature on the Fear and Desire Blu-ray. But that's what we're looking at next. And when we do Kubrick, we are looking at a chronological view. And the next time we come back to Hitchcock, it's going to be one of his lesser known pieces with Young and Innocent, which is a 1937 film of his.
We are going to do the Kubrick films under the Is It Psycho banner, though. I guess that'll be our banner for the, you know, masterpiece directors, if we cover any others as we go along. So, you know, if you listeners have any interest, those films are available, although I don't think, you know, they would come up on your suggested films on your, you know, if you're not actively looking for them. So, you know, we're giving you, that's the whole reason to give it to you now, is to give you an opportunity to find them, which, again, I think YouTube is pretty open on that, and I'm pretty sure Prime is also. So you should be able to find them if you have the desire. In the meanwhile, thank you to our panel again, as always. This is always fun to do, and thank you, everybody, for listening. Bye-bye.
Lisa! Lisa!
Precinct 6, Sergeant Allgood.
Hello. Hello. Look, a man is assaulting a woman at 125 West 9th Street, second floor, at the rear. No, make it fast.
Name?
L.B. Jeffries. Chelsea 25598.
Here they come.